Yeah, they just that there hasn't been.
Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee will come to order. Senator Wigger, you're first with Senate File 18. Senator Wigger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 18 is a resolution to Congress. It asks that there be a special counsel appointed to get serious information about POWs and MIAs. We need a full accounting. I have expert testimony today as to why this is needed. I know you, members of the committee, are deeply committed to our veterans, but we can never forget those that have not yet been accounted for. Some 90,000 persons, it's estimated. So I have three witnesses. Rich Daly, who's the executive director of Minnesota Won't Forget POW-MIA. He'll be followed by Larry Ryan, the commander of the North St. Paul American Legion. And finally, we'll hear from Stan Kowalski, the state VFW commander from Minnesota. Mr. Chair, with your permission, we'll call on Rich Daly.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
My name is Rich Daly, Executive Director of Minnesota Won't Forget POW-MIA. We've got eight members on our board of directors, three family members of still unaccounted for men from the Vietnam War. My father was a prisoner of war of the Japanese, taken prisoner on Bataan in World War II. And we've been trying for many, many years to try and get some answers. There are still a lot of difficulties in Washington. I think the U.S. Congress recognizes this. Last session, there were 280 members of the House of Representatives who co-sponsored a resolution to create a select POW-MIA committee. All eight members of the Minnesota delegation co-sponsored that resolution, but there was no committee. It always seems that the POW-MIA issue takes a second seat. I know that there's a lot of families that still have not been provided documents from the U.S. government. That's still a problem. It might come as a surprise. We've actually been to federal court to obtain documents from the various agencies, and it's just like pulling teeth. We believe that the families, the next of kin of the missing in action, should be able to see what the U.S. government has. And we're in absolute full support of this resolution. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman, members, for this opportunity to testify before this committee. My name is Larry Ryan. I'm the commander of the North St. Paul American Legion, Post 39. I'm a retired police officer from the United States Air Force. During my military career, I served for 7 years in the Republic of the Philippines, and on three occasions, I had the honor to escort remains of POWs and MIAs that had been recovered from Vietnam. There was no fanfare, no press coverage, just a simple honor guard to carry the transfer case from the plane to the hearse, then escort it back to the plane for the next leg on the return home to be identified and laid to rest. It is difficult to remain dry-eyed when you see the tail of the plane open, the cargo ramp drop, and see the American flag covering the case containing a fellow veteran that had paid the ultimate price, finally going home. We need to urge the U.S. government to continue these efforts to find and or account for every American service member that never was returned and provide a sense of closures for their families and the American people. As of today, there are 1,789 Americans still missing from the Vietnam War, 8,056 from Korea, 74,384 from World War II, and 4,452 from World War I. That's a total of 88,681 veterans. The POW-MIA issue is of paramount concern to the American Legion. The Legion's mandate on this issue commits us to keep the spotlight on securing the full accounting for all POWs and MIAs from the Gulf War, the war in Southeast Asia, the Cold War, the Korean War, and World War II. Full accounting means the return of live POWs, the repatriation of their remains, or convincing evidence why neither of these is possible. The American Legion will continue to speak out and exert maximum pressure on both the administration and on the Congress to fully account for America's POWs and MIAs. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I strongly support and urge the passage of Senate File 18, which will hopefully compel the Congress of the United States to never forget our fallen comrades and to continue to exert every effort to account for and hopefully bring home every last POW and MIA. I thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak today before this committee.
Welcome. State your name for the record.
My name is Stan Kowalski. I'm the state commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I'm a World War II vet. And I'd like to say the heart, strength, and soul of this nation is the military units of the United States of America. Those that wear the uniform of our country have pledged to support it, honor it, and protect it. They've been offered and promised things by the national government who is not keeping their promise. The identification of veterans that are now considered POW/MIAs is a detriment to the forces of our country that should not be just cast aside because those that are sitting in Congress today are letting it slide by in order to get other things done. Nothing would have got done if it hadn't been for those in uniform that stepped up to protect this country. They are owed that. They are owed the families that have these people that are missing in action and killed in action. They deserve closure. You cannot sit in those seats in Washington and let it ride by. Our state has firmly and committedly come up and up and up, but it doesn't seem that they listen to us. The next time they call, how are you going to ask veterans to step up and help you, and young people step up to help you when the government of this country won't keep its promise to its veterans? Now, I'm asking you to write a letter to defend our rights as veterans and defend the rights of those that are still missing in action to get final clarification. I've been to what I call CILHI, the Central Intelligence Agency, that identify remains that come back in Hawaii. There are hundreds of, possibly thousands, of parts of bodies there that they cannot identify, first off, because they don't have enough support there to help identify them. The place is very weak in the amount of people they've got there to identify DNAs with the things they have. The other thing that a lot of people don't realize is that a man's DNA will last about 3 months. It's the mother's and sister's DNA that lasts for years and years. So what I'm trying to do, along with getting these POW/MIAs identified, is to get the word out to the mothers and sisters to make sure your DNA is listed, especially if you have somebody that is missing in action today. When a person gets missing in action, you don't close the file on them. And it seems that's what they've done. We've been in Baghdad 5 years, yet Commander Spiker, who have definite proof was living and marched through Baghdad, was seen last in Baghdad, yet they have made no attempt that we know of for sure to identify where he is or where his remains are. Hell, if they want $5,000 to offer as a reward, I'll put it up myself. We've got to get some closure to these people. We need you to help us. I stand here telling you I will continue to serve those veterans that are still in action and those that are missing and presumed KIAs until I join their ranks as a KIA. And thank you much for listening to me.
Senator Berger, do you have anybody else?
Mr. Chair, members, that concludes our testimony. Any would yield if there is questions. I'm not sure if there's anyone else
that
wish to address.
Senator, I think you are carrying a good piece, a good resolution, because I go to parades around to my, I go to about 26 of them, and there are POW, missing in action flags marching in every one of those parades that I go in. So this is just another step. Senator Dale.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Wieger, I thank you for bringing this resolution forward, and thank you to all the witnesses who testified. As I was listening to this, I noted that one of your witnesses listed a number that was a little different than what you got in the resolution. I think he said 88,600 and some. So I'm wondering if that's accurate. And then I was also thinking about the issue of the DNA. I didn't know that the DNA from men was different than the DNA from women. But I was also wondering if, you know, what kind of records we've got going back to World War I in terms of DNA evidence, so that if some bones are found, for example, in some battlefield in Europe from World War I or II, do we have a record of the DNA from these missing people so we can match it up?
Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I believe it is 88,115 persons that are unaccounted for, and we have a breakdown of that. I believe Commander Ryan had a number fairly close to that. Regarding the DNA question,
when I was out there in Sillai, they were telling me that their problem is they don't have enough DNAs from people to help identify what they do have out there. So that's why I'm kind of asking you people to help me get the word out. Tell these mothers and sisters to get that DNA sample in if they've got somebody in the service, especially today, or those that have POW-MIAs. Now, I know the World War II vets, we're all getting old, but we're still here, and we did our job. It's up to you to help us finish the job by making those people in Washington stand up and take notice of what they promised. Make them stand up and keep their promises. We kept our promise to them. They owe it to them.
Thank you, sir. Senator Wigger, is that it? Oh, Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you dearly for the testimony. I have a friend, or I had a friend back in high school that was missing in Vietnam since the later 60s, and as I told the gentleman before the committee started today, that he was his remains were finally brought back here about 6 years ago, and that's over 30 some years that my friend Rick Knutson had been missing and went down in a helicopter. So I know what it's about when the family putting some closure to that, because the mother stayed alive until the very year that he was brought back, and she passed away shortly after that. So. It was a very touching story, and there's a lot of those kind of stories, and thank you so much for your testimony.
What we need from you is a resolution with some teeth in it and send it to our Congress people from our state to carry the law at the Capitol. We've got some real good people there, but they need to be prodded once in a while by our home folks.
Any other questions? Not Senator Dill moves that Senate File 18, POW-MIA, Congressional Resolution be recommended, passed, and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Koch here. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you. Today, so today we have Senate File 755, and what we are attempting to do with this bill is to define for agricultural purposes horses. We'd like to see them put an ag statute as livestock is the purpose with our bill. Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, and I'm wondering if someone can offer. It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, I'll offer the Senator Koch's amendment.
Everybody have a copy of the item? Okay, this will just get your bill in the order that you want.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This will just get us in order and align us with the House bill as well.
I don't know if we want to talk too much about the House. I watched them for 3 hours the other day, and I don't want to get into that.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn moves that adoption of the A1 amendment to get the bill in order that you'd like to have it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator, you're ready.
Well, thank you. And so, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to actually turn it over to the experts with me today is Dave Dan from St. Michael. And he's the one that came to me with the suggestions for the bill.
The committee, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is David Dayon from St. Michael, Minnesota. I testified before you previously on this issue. Just to clarify, the horses are the third largest livestock class in the state, and they have to be defined. There are several statutes currently in existence, and in your packet you will find there are five existing statutes and one set of administrative rules that explicitly say horses means beef, cattle, swine, horses.
Livestock.
Livestock means cattle, sheep, swine, horses. Livestock means cattle, horses, swine, sheep, and goats. Livestock means live, dead cattle, sheep, swine, horses. Livestock means cattle, sheep, swine, horses, ponies, donkeys, mules. I think it's fairly clear that horses are considered livestock in existing legislation, existing statutes that are now on the books. The only intent of this bill is to put horses as livestock under Chapter 17, Department of Agriculture. That's the only class of livestock that doesn't get explained under Chapter 17 of the Department of Agriculture. That is the only intent of the bill, is to just simply define them as livestock under the Department of Agriculture. As it relates to animal cruelty issues, this language of this bill uses the word equine, which is not used in some other cases. It explicitly refers to existing animal cruelty statute number 346.38, which explicitly deals with equines and the associated issues with them. This definition is similar to definitions used for other classes of livestock. Example being llamas. If you were to look up the llama statute, the language used to describe llamas is almost identical to this language here. This bill does three things. It defines horses as livestock, explains what they are used for, and also explains how they are raised, in what methods, and for what reasons. Horses are livestock, and they're farm animals. They are not pets. And if you refer to the Board of Animal Health definitions, you will see that the definition for pet does not include any language that would even apply to a horse, whereas the definition under subpart 2A, farm animal, explicitly lists horses. Horses are not pets, they're livestock. That's all we ask to be accomplished with this bill. With that, I thank you very much, and I'll be available for questions.
Any questions? Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is just generally to the committee. The terms pets or livestock, I'm wondering if we're excluding or I'm fine with including horses as livestock. I think that's just fine. But to not call them pets, I think there are some families that have horses simply as pets. And I also know families that have sheep just as pets. My best friend has two sheep. Now, Senator Dill might think that's so ridiculous. But, you know, there are people that do keep animals that are classified as livestock as pets. So I'm just wondering if we go to a point where we're saying they are only livestock and not pets. I mean, are there some statutory implications that we're going to paint ourselves into a corner over.
Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, where does it say pets in here or not pets? Or?
I was just listening to the Mr. Chair and Senator Deal, I was just listening to the testimony of, I'm sorry, Mr. Dayton.
Okay.
Chairman Vickerman and Senator Erickson Ropes, in answer to your question, pets is a very, very loosely used term. It's used to describe anything from a tiger to a chimpanzee to a boa constrictor, an alligator, a dog, a cat, a rat, or here a few years back, even a rock. I mean, we had rocks back in the 70s. But having said that, at the end of the day, the tiger's still a wild animal, the boa constrictor's still a snake, the rat is still a rodent, pigs and horses are still livestock, and a rock is still a rock. So you can call them whatever, you can call anything you want a pet, but that doesn't change its classification. And under the law here, it explicitly says under the rule here pertaining to the Board of Health, they define what they consider a pet. And they say that horses are not pets, they are farm animals. So be it whether you have one or 100 of them, they still fall under the classification. Too often people say that they've made a pet out of something and they think that that changes its classification, and that's not the case. On city ordinance levels, you will find that horses and cattle and sheep and pigs are not considered pets. They're considered livestock under city ordinance rules for that very reason. Someone can come in and say that whatever it may be, they've suddenly decided that an elephant is a pet. Just because they call it a pet doesn't change its status. It's still what it is. And in this case, horses are still livestock, no matter whether you call them a pet or not.
Senator Dale, you had a follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm a guy that's used a lot of horses over the years for a lot of work. And when I was younger, I actually farmed about 60 acres for 3 years with nothing but draft horses. Didn't own a tractor. And I've been a rodeo cowboy starting at age 11 up until age 28, except for the 3 years when I was in Vietnam. And when I came home from Vietnam and started farming my veterinary practice, we used horses a lot. And with my 125 beef cows, I had some Charolais Angus cross cows that didn't like people when they had their calves on the ground. So it was dangerous walking around out there trying to work with them. And I remember one time it was not uncommon for a cow to come after you to try to protect her calf. And I remember one time my son got pinned to the ground by an Angus Charolais cow. She had her calf right there. And so we just, when those cows started calving, we saddled a horse at the beginning of April, and that horse was saddled every day from 7 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night until we were through calving, probably into July sometime, and used them a lot for moving cattle around and rounding up cattle. And at that time, I had about a half dozen pastures with 12 miles of fence. So the one thing I see that's missing here that I kind of like to stick in here somewhere is rounding up livestock. Horses and other equines raised for purposes of riding, driving, competition, racing, recreation, sale, or breeding stock. Those are all things that kind of and the word riding can include a lot of different things, but one of the purposes of horses on a livestock farm is to round up livestock. So I'm just wondering if we could insert that at an appropriate location, which would kind of expand the definition a little bit. And besides rounding up livestock, horses are used to just move livestock around or to rope a calf. If there's a lame animal on pasture and you want to treat it, the horse can be used to rope that calf and treat it right on pasture. And there have been times in rainstorms where I've gone out on the pasture and wanted to get these cows and their new calf out of the rain, and it was hard to do it if you got off the horse because the cow would take after you. So I just rope the calf from the back of the horse, pull the calf up in the saddle, lay it across the front of the saddle, and carry it into the barn, and the cow would follow. Do you have video of that, Senator Dealey?
I also had a situation several times where I went out where dogs were killing my sheep, and I shot the dogs in the back of a horse and then brought the dogs back home. And so at any rate, from my standpoint, I've used a lot of horses a lot just for farm work in different ways. So if it's okay with the author, I'd like to add the words Roundup Livestock somewhere in that on line 1.8.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, we don't have any problem with that.
Could I possibly, Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, could we just say working cat or working livestock? Would that be satisfactory?
Something like that, yeah, that would probably be better.
Farm work.
More encompassing.
Insert the language.
But maybe Mr. Knopf has got some ideas.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I was thinking you might want to just insert after driving, comma, insert control of other livestock, because you're defining them as livestock here, the other types of livestock.
Okay, I thought, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, I thought about that also, but on the other hand, horses can be used to control horses also. Horses can be used for rounding up horses and roping horses and so forth if you need to do that. But so you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, the other horses would be other livestock, but.
So rounding up livestock includes horses, rounding up horses. And so your suggestion is to say what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I just thought control of other livestock.
I'm sorry.
And you were saying working livestock.
I'm fine with either term.
Mr. Chair, working
well,
other livestock.
Well, let's go with Mr. Knopf because he's almost always right.
Senator Dill, you want to move that?
I'll move that.
Mr. Knopf, what's it say?
Mr. Chairman, it's after driving, comma, insert control of other livestock, comma.
Everybody understands it?
So, Mr. Chairman, I just mention one other time when we were using horses. In 1991, during the Halloween blizzard, which was a blizzard of the century, I had just bought 700 feeder lambs from Faith, South Dakota, and brought them home and turned them loose on a cornfield. And it was Halloween night, and I saddled a horse to go out and get them. And by the time I got out there, it was snowing so bad I couldn't hardly find them all. And I brought them into the barn with a horse, and the barn wasn't full enough. So I knew I must have missed some of them out there. But what they did is they went into a CRP field with switchgrass growing in it, native prairie grass, where they never would go normally because they can't see each other, but they found shelter out there. And after the blizzard lasted for 2 days, I went out there with two horses and a tractor and my four kids, and we searched that switchgrass, and we pulled about 100 lambs out of the switchgrass, carried some of them out of there on the back of a horse. And the barn still didn't seem full enough. But the blizzard was raging, and so we waited till everything settled down. I went back out there with a horse, and I found about another 100 head or so that got into a drainage ditch, and they found shelter there. So again, with my kids and two horses and a tractor, we plowed a path out through the snow and got those sheep out of that drainage ditch and back to the barn. So just another example where I was using horses to get my job done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dill, to your point, I think we could listen to you tell stories all afternoon. It's pretty interesting. But I'm wondering if, you know, when we start getting so specific on uses, maybe we should do something more general, like for just to use horses for farm work. Because we could ask, you know, talk about rescuing instead of driving, you know, other livestock. So, I mean, if we start listing too many things and we're going to, miss one of the stories that you've talked about here. And I wonder if there's something more general that would be more inclusive and just say use of horses for farm work.
Use of horses for farm and ranch work.
That works.
Why don't we say that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, Senator Exenrope. Again, after driving, comma, insert farm or ranch work. So it would be driving farm or ranch work competition. That works.
Your question on the...
Mr. Chair, I'll wait until after we vote on the bill amendment.
Okay. All in favor of Senator Dill's motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now, where are we at? I have Coring. Senator Coring. You.
Well, I was just, all I was going to say is I have some pet rocks on my farm that I'd like to sell if anybody was interested. They're for sale. So.
I was just sitting here halfway dreaming. I was wondering, what do they do about this? There are Amish people that live in this country.
Yes.
And they use those horses for transportation, mm-hmm. for everything. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about pets, I grew up, my dad had a thrashing rig, and he had about 20 teams. I scared the death of them. They weren't pets. They were mean as hell. They weren't livestock. They weren't pets. I can guarantee you that.
Mr. Okay, Chair, this committee has too much fun.
thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't have any trouble with this classification of horses as livestock in Chapter 17, but as I've listened to Senator Koch and the witness talk about, they have no intention of this applying to the tax provisions, and that there would be some potential conflicts, and to make sure that sometime down the road some legislature doesn't try to clarify that conflict outside of what the Senate author's intent is, I would ask that we add an amendment that this classification doesn't apply to the property tax articles, and I think Mr. Knopf would have some language for me.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment would be a new Subdivision 3. This isn't too long, but it's a little bit longer for an oral amendment. Subdivision 3 had noted non-applicability for property tax laws, and then the section, the one sentence of the subdivision would be, this section does not apply to the treatment of land used for raising horses under Chapter 273.
And Mr. Chair, I think I've talked to the witness and Senator Koch earlier, and they both implied that that wasn't their intent today, so I would ask to adopt that amendment.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, we have no problem with that amendment, and frankly, we've gone back and forth whether this – we don't want to muddy the waters, we're not interested in muddying the waters, and we've gotten varied opinions depending on the day, frankly, on whether it will or not. And so I think that some adding that amendment gives some comfort language, and I would assume then, Mr. Chair, that we would have to go to perhaps the tax –
going to go to taxes anyways.
Just going to taxes anyway. So that's fine with us. That's fine with us.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, we can send this to taxes. I think with the addition of that language, we might want to check with the tax chair. They might not need to see it anymore.
Do you want to make that a motion to put that on there?
Yes, I want to move that amendment.
I don't understand the amendment. So can it just be explained a little bit more?
Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, I just happen to have the language that this applies to because I'm working on my favorite Green Acres issue. But in the property tax area, there are different classifications for receiving the ag classification rate, which is a significant property tax break. Yes. And there's a specific article that deals with the commercial boarding of horses. And if the commercial boarding of horses is done in conjunction with raising or cultivating ag products, it is defined as agricultural land. But if it is done not in conjunction with that, then it is not agricultural land. And livestock is considered agricultural land.
Right.
So I think with this change in classifying horses livestock, somebody's going to say we have a conflict between the two statutes. And I just want to make it clear that this classification change is to apply to Chapter 17 and not to Chapter 273, and I think everybody has kind of agreed to that. Mm-hmm.
So then, if somebody has got 20 or 30 horses and they're actually raising it, it's a business, and they're selling horses, then would that farm or ranch be eligible for Green Acres or agricultural status then?
Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, well, it would depend on the nature of the business and whether they are raising their own feed. If they have pasture land, that would very likely qualify. But if they are just boarding horses, they probably wouldn't. Now, it is even more complicated than that because we try to keep everything in conformity with federal statutes, and the IRS says that the boarding of horses has to be dealt with if it's a business or operating in a business-like manner. So probably if they had 20 horses and they were pasturing them and had a barn for them, they would very likely receive the ag classification, but they would have to have at least 10 acres of land.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, who would make that determination?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, I believe the local assessor would be the starting point. And if the local assessor didn't feel that he had the information to do it, he could get guidance from the department. Uh-huh. Now, I understand the department testified in a previous or another committee in the House, I believe it was, which I'm not supposed to bring that up, but I will, that this change does not affect them. And it doesn't affect 273. It just affects Chapter 17. But I would be more comfortable if we were clarifying this.
Oh, okay.
Senator Chaudhry,
Mr. Chairman, can I ask another question?
Follow up? Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, right now, if you go to Fleet Farm and you're going to get let's say I'm going to get some fencing materials for cattle, it's tax deductible. But if I go in to get fencing equipment for horses, it is not tax deductible. Is that correct? And then is this going to change that? This doesn't have anything to do with that, does it? Or?
Senator Coring, just keep that question because we're going to get an assessor up here pretty quick.
Okay.
Before I do that, I'm going to go to Senator. No, did I?
No, I know.
Chaudhry, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the amendment raises the question for me even more. What's the I don't understand as yet the context of the bill. Help me understand what activities you cannot do now under current law that the bill will now allow you to do.
The bill clarifies the definition of the raising of horses as livestock. Currently in several statutes they are defined as livestock, but in no statute is there a description describing what the actual raising of horses consists of. I think that you may hear some testimony from the Department of Ag concerning other forms of livestock have similar language already in existence under Chapter 17 that do exactly that. They describe the actual process of what is involved with the raising of other forms of livestock. This bill simply does that same thing for horses as it does for other forms of other livestock under Chapter 17 right now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I understand what the explanation of the bill. What I'm trying to understand is the practical effect of the bill. What are you not able to do under current law that this bill will allow you to now do?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry,
your activities.
Like I said, this bill explains the activities that are done with horses. Currently, the only thing that you refer to horses as livestock, and then each one has their own individual perception. This is what's led to some of the problems within the revenue issues, is that everyone has a different perception of what the raising of horses consists of. Someone might think they're pets. Someone might think that it means someone who, as Senator Dill said, uses livestock for working animals. And with someone else might think it refers to the show horses. Someone else might think it refers to the people that are just doing trail riding. What this bill does is it explains what each one of those situations is.
My dad must have had a different breed of horses. They were mean. They weren't pets. They were just mean. Well,
so then I guess follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay. So help me then understand what the revenue issues are. What can't or what bad is happening now with regards to revenue that this will make good?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I think that's another one of the misunderstandings, is that they're having a problem classifying horses. I don't think the horse people that I've talked to as it pertains to Green Acres, the horse people aren't even interested in Green Acres. I think if you ask the horse people, if you want to put in an amendment that says horses are banned from Green Acres, nobody's going to say a word. We don't want anything to do with Green Acres. It would be nice if we were considered an agricultural enterprise, though, so that we would still our land would still be classified as agricultural, but we have no interest in Green Acres whatsoever. But we've been drawn into the discussion, again, by perception. We hope with this legislation to have a clear definition of what's going on so that we don't have to deal with all these perceptions that everyone has.
Senator Ropes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to Senator Skoy's amendment on the tax issue. It seems to me that we need to deal with maybe the definition of what livestock is here in this committee, and then I think it's appropriate that the bill goes to a tax committee to deal with the minutiae and ramifications of taxes. And I appreciate your explanation, Senator Skoy, but I feel like I'm starting to make tax decisions for a tax committee when maybe they're going to have a lot of questions that they want to turn over related to this bill.
Mr. Chair and committee, if I could. These are some of the discussions that we've had surrounding this bill. That's not the intention of this bill. I think just from the experience that I've had with carrying this bill, that perhaps a tax discussion on livestock, on horses, to Senator Chaudhry's questions, to Senator Coring's questions, you can see a lot of the questions that come up. That's not the intention of this bill. It's probably a different bill and maybe another day. But so I think why I'm fine with Senator Skoy's amendment is that it takes away that discussion, but I would certainly encourage this committee and potentially the tax committee to have that discussion. I think it's a good one. It's certainly come up as an issue just on this bill, which has really nothing to do with taxes.
Did you want to hear from the other witness down there?
Oh, Mr. Chair, did you want to hear from Mr. Zimmerman with the Department of Ag?
I'm Kurt Zimmerman. I'm the Livestock Development Supervisor for the Department of Agriculture. My job is overseeing various livestock programs at the department. One answer to the question of what this bill may or may not do as far as clarification, I can give you two or three examples that I was involved in that may help clarify that. This past year, this body passed the Livestock Investment Grant Program. Horses weren't initially included in that. They are now, and they were this past year. But they had to be added in Section 17 under the definition of what were included in livestock. So in 17.118, we defined what livestock were as far as the grant program. We actually had to put horses into that language. In that section, there's various descriptions of what is a llama, what is a ratite, the emus, the various other forms, but equine are not in Section 17. 17A talks about licensing and bonding, and horses are mentioned, but very specifically, and we don't want to touch that area. So it is a clarification. Another example would be in a drought or statewide flood assistance program or a forage program. Two, 3 years ago, we had a drought situation in the state of Minnesota where we provided some hay assistance. It's in some programs we said that horses and horse farms were included, and others it was a gray area, and we really didn't know if they were or not. It is an industry that is substantially larger than many other areas that are defined very clearly in state statutes. We have 13,000 horses, according to the 2007, or 13,000 horse and pony farms in the state, and 90,000 according to the 2007 census. That isn't all the horses in the state, but according to the National Agriculture Statistics Service, that is how many horses and horse farms we have. So it's a big industry, a lot larger than probably we've given definition to. So that's basically our position from the department. Is it would help from some clarification in state programs that we have come up from time to time.
Thank you. I want to hear from the assessor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rob Vanosik on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. With me in the audience is Tom Hauslog from Rock County Land Records Office. We're neutral on the goal of the bill. We've had extensive conversations with Mr. Dayan, the bill's authors, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Revenue. And we do appreciate the language that we understand this bill does not give any preferential treatment to horses. The amendment that was just adopted by the committee clarifies that. We're comfortable with it going taxes just to make sure that that is what happens. But, you know, if the if the bill were to go ahead and create a new class, commercial agriculture, and give preferential treatment to horses, we've talked about that, kicked it around, and decided authors did not decide to do that and just leave it as a definition and maybe come back another day with a more clear path down that road.
Now, Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, just so then if there are implications on some of the ag programming, will the bill have a fiscal impact by expanding the definition of the what can be allowed into the program?
Senator Vickerman and Senator, at this point, I don't see any impact. It would be more of a clarification on how we administer the dollars that are part of the program. It may mean fewer dollars spread out to more people. It may be more inclusive or not. So it's more of a matter of how the programs are administered. So I don't see any. The only area that would have an impact in the bottom line of our division would be a change in 17A where we talk about licensing and bonding, and that's not an issue that we're dealing with in Statute 17.
The last question, Mr. Chair.
Chaudhry.
Do you see horses raised for the purposes of perhaps riding or recreation as something that needs to qualify under the livestock investment grant? I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. You know more. And then secondly, do we need to have the line on the sentence on 1.9 about horses may be used for meat, hides, and animal byproducts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, that's already been removed in the office.
So that was
amendment.
Already moved?
Yep.
Okay.
So thank you.
So then just the first question.
Chairman Vickerman and Senator, the Livestock Investment Grant Program dealt with the products or services of the industry. And I had a chance to work with the 12 or so applications that came in, and many were involved in a variety of various enterprises with their horses. The average investment was a couple hundred thousand dollars for these 12 applications. Some were putting up new paddocks, new riding stables. Many are involved in various programs with youth where they provide services. So there's a variety of services that are part of the horse industry that aren't with other livestock. So I think the clarification really is not necessary at this time.
We need to move along, members. We're on your amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's what I think we're on the amendment to add that language restricting this to Section 17. I think I heard the assessors say that they thought that was a good addition to the bill. Senator Koch and Mr. Dayan, are you agreeing that that's the intent of what you're trying to do, just so we're clear?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, we are in agreement, and we're fine with the amendment.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for offering it.
And I think, Senator Koch, if this amendment gets adopted, we'll save you a stop to the Tax Committee because I don't believe you'll have to go there if we put this amendment on. So I would move the amendment, the oral amendment that Mr. Knopf has read, and perhaps he wants to read it again. I don't know.
Mr. Knopf, you read that.
Mr. Chairman, it's after line 1.16, add a new subdivision titled Non-Applicability for Property Tax Laws. And the sentence would read, this section does not apply to the treatment of land used for raising horses under Chapter 273.
Everybody understand amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So adopted. I need somebody to move the bill. Senator Hahn moves that Senate file 755 as amended be recommended to pass. We'll send it to the floor, and if the tax somebody wants it from there, they can pull it. Right now, we'll send it to the floor. Everybody agree with that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fobey. Welcome to the committee, Senator. Let's hear about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm here today to introduce to you to talk about Senate file number 858, which is in front of you, and hoping that this isn't as complex as the last bill, just if I can start. It always makes a new person a little nervous when you see all that back and forth going on. So just preface with that. Colonel Eric Alness is here today to explain the bill. I would just like to, I first have a verbal author's amendment and would like to offer that before I get started. Just to clarify, it would put us in line with the House bill. And I've talked with Mr. Tom Bodern about the language.
Mr. Chairman, the required or the suggested amendment would be just changing the way the bill refers to Commissioner of Military Affairs, and you can simply say the Adjutant General. So there are two places you need to do that. On page 1, line 3 in the title, delete Commissioner of Military Affairs and insert the Adjutant General. And on page 1, line 8, delete Commissioner of, and on page 1, line 9, delete Military Affairs and insert Adjutant General.
Does everybody understand it? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopt, and now your bill is ready.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just offer a little that this bill would allow the Adjutant General to accept uncompensated voluntary services and enter into agreements if necessary with private or public agencies or people for these services as is practical. This bill would also allow that these people be reimbursed for travel expenses while they're performing their volunteer service. And with that, I'll turn it over to Colonel Eric Alness to describe the bill a little further.
Welcome to committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Colonel Eric Alness, the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota National Guard. This bill's coming up as a result of our reintegration effort and our Yellow Ribbon Communities effort. What we find is that we have a lot of volunteers coming together to support the returning veterans to the state, veterans who serve overseas and then come back home. And we find we don't have the authority within the state to accept these services, and this really clarifies and authorizes our ability to accept those services. And we lifted this language from language that already exists for the Department of Veterans Affairs, so similar language is already in state statute. Now, four things I want to emphasize on this language. First and foremost, is that in no way would this ever be used to replace existing full-time or part-time staff anywhere else. And we're specifically prohibited from doing that in federal statute and other places of state statute. So just want to make sure that we're not looking at using this in any way to disadvantage any of our state partners or other state employees. Secondly, it provides a status in the event there's an injury of a volunteer who's working for us or an accident, so that we can make sure we can provide for those volunteers who are really there to support us and helps clarify how are they working for us. Third, it allows compensation for the travel of key volunteers. And I want to emphasize key volunteers. Not everyone who comes together in the community are we looking at giving them reimbursement for it. This is just the exceptional volunteers who maybe have formed a group already and we're taking them to another city so they can help form the leadership of a new town and get them started. So instead of having those individuals having to have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses, we would provide them limited amount of reimbursement so they don't lose money in helping the returning veterans. And then finally, one of the issues brought up in the House was the reimbursement rules, would that become a taxable event for the volunteers? And we researched both the federal and state rules on that, would make sure that our reimbursement would not qualify as taxable income. First of all, we would not give any stipends for this, so we're not paying any volunteers. Secondly, we would make sure we work within the IRS rules so that the mileage reimbursement would be consistent, so it's not a taxable income. And then finally, they wouldn't be reimbursed for meals unless there's an overnight stay. So that's consistent with state and federal rules. And again, we don't want to make it so it's a taxable event for volunteers. Just reduce any out-of-pocket expenses. Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony, and stand by for any questions.
Any questions? I'm phobia, I should say.
Thank you.
You want to move your bill?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I stumped all of a sudden, so help me with the wording here. So
here's what it should be.
Okay.
You should move that Senate File 858 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to finance.
Referred to finance. That's the piece I forgot, that finance piece. So
all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Next bill up is Senator Roques. You have a...
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here today with Senate File 0289, and I have the A1 amendment. Mr. Chair, do you have the A1 amendment? Okay. This is a delete everything amendment. I have had some conversations with a lot of the stakeholders, and I've just decided to not repeal the sunset, but just bump it out 4 years. We're not dealing with any of the other details of the bill. So the only point of interest for this committee today is just the deadline. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
Senator Roques moves the adoption of the A1 amendment to get a bill in order that you'd like to have. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Farmer Lender Mediation Bill. It comes up every 2 years for review. It's got a 2-year review date on it. And there had been some thinking about sunsetting the repeal date. And in conversations that I've had with people, I think we've decided not to ask for a full repeal of the sunset. But instead of everybody looking at this every 2 years, there's lots of resources poured into it, and it's been renewed every year for many, many years, that maybe what we should do, given the economic times right now and the fact that farmers are probably going to be using this mediation process even more due to the economy, we just push it out to 4 years, to 2013, and then come back in 4 years and review it. It's a program that's been working very successfully across the state. There were some questions about whether we should get into the mechanics of the program and adjust different features like the trigger, the cost trigger, moving it from 5,000 to other numbers. And I think what I would recommend to the committee is we just deal with pushing the sunset date out to 2013, and in the meantime then, maybe we can get together a group of people who are interested to reveal all the details of the program itself.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, do we have any information about how many cases there are between, say, $5,000 and $50,000? There's this chart that was in the folder here, which shows quite a bit of information. But my guess is that even though we start this mediation at $5,000 debt, which has been in place for a couple decades, I would think most of the debts are much larger than that. And are there really any being mediated, say, in the $5,000 to $10,000 range, or $5,000 to $50,000? Or does anybody have that information?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dick Sinise. I'm an associate dean with the University of Minnesota Extension. Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, the way that the program operates is we have an aggregate amount of information about a farmer's debts rather than specific detailed information about every loan. However, if you think about the $5,000 level, you know, raising that too fast, too quickly, we'd really want to consider the impact of that on the sort of local small businesses, such as fuel operators, feed operators, and other locally owned businesses. For example, in 2008, over $9.5 million of debt for those locally owned businesses was mediated through our program. And so while those numbers aren't readily available and we can work on getting some clarification on that, but they aren't readily available to us, we do know that there are a number of debts that are at the $5,000 level that get into this program.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, to Senator Dill's point about increasing the dollar trigger point, you know, just when I was getting to the point where I thought, well, it's been in statute for quite a long time, maybe we at least need to adjust it for inflation. Then I heard some information from Doug Peterson, Farm Bureau, who said that just this last month or so, I'm sorry, Farmers Union, oops, excuse me. Farmers Union said that he had just signed up, how many new members, sir? 150 new members who are very small growers that produce for local farmers markets. And for them, a $5,000 trigger point would be very significant. So we want to make sure that we're not closing the door for opportunities for farmers in Minnesota to be able to access mediation, the process.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Erickson Ropes, the chart that's here is kind of telling the tale, I think, of the average debt to the borrower, I think, on the second from the left column. I'm not sure exactly how you can explain the $991,000 in 2006 or why it drops down to $273,000, but it appears that the $5,000 figure may be very, very, very low. As Senator Dill had explained earlier, this is over 20 years old, so would it be reasonable to expect maybe, or is there going to be some conversation as such of raising it? What I'm wondering, it just seems like it's quite low.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbrechtson, my preference on this bill, the details of the program, would be to have some conversation either during the interim when we go through the actual mechanics of the program and have a more thorough conversation about that. Because, as I said, just when, you know, it starts to make sense that you at least increase that trigger point for inflation, then you realize that there's a lot of new farmers coming into the industry that may need a lower threshold. So I want to be very careful before we go down the path of making programmatic changes that we're hearing from all the stakeholders across the state. So that's why my recommendation today, too, is just to deal with the sunset date provision, and perhaps this committee can consider convening a group during the interim to talk about program changes.
Mr. Chair, Senator, one information that we could provide that might be a little more illustrative and sort of get to your point about needing to dig into it a bit more is the range of the amount of debt. When I looked at this recently, some debts, say, to locally owned businesses, you know, that get into the program are small, but some are quite large. And so this average is really kind of misleading if you just look at the average without looking at the full range that's available. And again, the $5,000 is the triggering event. That's the debt that triggers mediation. And then all debt is brought into the program. And so I think taking some time to really dig into it with the many stakeholders might provide some clarity.
Senator Gimsey, I believe you had your hand up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. could you inform us, you know, that aren't that familiar with this program, what the time requirements would be for, say, just one case as far as a bank goes or those people that are involved in the mediation process? So
sure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, the maximum time involved is 90 days. There's no more time than that involved. When we receive a copy of the credit notice, that goes, the person holding the debt has 14 days in which to decide whether or not to pursue mediation or waive it. From that moment on, and it's a 90-day window that mediation has to conclude itself in. After that, all the parties have access to any course of action they would have had beforehand. if they do not successfully complete mediation, for example, any course of action is available. However, 80% of cases that do request mediation, we do come up with a solution that's really a win-win, both for the lenders, the small businesses that may be carrying that debt, as well as the farmer.
Can I follow up just follow up briefly? Could we take it a step further back, if we could? What is the time requirement on the part of, say, a bank that that entered, if say the farmer enters into this mediation, how much, can you give us an idea of how much time the bank spends putting together all of the documents, or who puts together all of the other debt? Since once they go into mediation, what are the man hours, if you will, person hours required to, on the part of banks and others, to go through this process?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, the way it works is once the creditor has notified the debtor and the program of the default on the obligation, the debtor is required, if they choose mediation, is required to submit all debts to the program. We then contact and arrange a first meeting, a kind of an orientation meeting between all creditors, the debtor, financial analysts from our program, and the mediator. And at that point, then, the financial analysts really work to create a common financial picture that everyone kind of agrees to. And it's from there, then, that mediation happens. Sometimes, you know, non-complicated cases are done over the phone, quite frankly. More complex cases, we've had to, you know, arrange in VFW halls and have many, many people there. But really, we've got this down. It's very efficient, and it's just really a few meetings that people are attending, either by phone or in person.
Appreciate that.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know, Senator Erickson Ropes, for maybe your witness, but can again, for purposes of familiarizing us with the bill or the law itself, what is the definition in the Act of a farmer? In other words, what is the minimum qualifications that you have to meet to qualify for the mediation program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe you have to have $20,000 in gross production, agricultural production, and I would have to look that up to find out for sure about that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Mr. Chairman, just is there a qualification on the amount of land that you have to own to participate as well?
Mr. Chair, maybe.
We have someone else who can come up with details here.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jill Krieger, and I'm a senior staff attorney at Farmers Legal Action Group here in St. Paul. And there's a requirement that the farmer own or rent a total of 60 acres or more.
And, Mr. Chairman, is the $20,000 gross production also the requirement? So 60 acres and or both?
I believe it's an alternative requirement, one or the other.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can read that definition. Senator Hand, if you like. Farmer-Lender Mediation Act does not apply to a debtor who owns or leases less than 60 acres if the debtor has less than $20,000 in gross of agricultural products the preceding year.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson Ropes, just another question too: is the creditor groups what are they in favor of extending the sunset, or would they rather just see the sunset expire?
I believe this comes up every 2 years, Mr. Chair, and every 2 years the committee extends the deadline to another 2 years. It seems to me the banks always have some concerns, although. It's my understanding they're not opposing. It's not one of those bills they love, but they're not opposing it. And the process from the agriculture community's position is that it does work, and they'd like to see it extended.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, is there anybody from that part of the finance world that could talk a little bit about this and just speak to the – we had a few questions about this, and I just would – if there's anybody here that –
Senator Hand. I have two more people, and then we're going to get three or four bankers up. Maybe if you would,
okay.
You could
– Absolutely.
Hold that question. Thank you, Jill. Jim Anderson, I believe it is. Is he here?
Mr. Chair, if I may maybe outline what about a little bit more about the program and then call Jim up, who's one of the staff from our program, if that's all right with the chair and the committee. So the program, to give you a little bit more context to it, is part of a national program, and I believe this is in your packet. There are 35 states that operate this program, and it was recently reauthorized under the Federal Farm Bill. As we mentioned, a creditor that has $5,000 or more debt secured against agricultural property offers mediation before being able to proceed with other actions, which they can then take after 90 days. That's when Extension really gets involved with this, and the first step is the orientation meeting I described. Mediation really requires two things to be successful. First is neutrality on part of the mediators, and secondly is compromise by both the debtor and the creditor. Farmers may have to change their operations to make it more profitable or to liquidate some of the secured assets. Creditors may need to restructure debt or reschedule payments. The mediator leads and manages this process as a neutral party and does not take sides or decide how the dispute should be resolved. The program is really part of Extension's commitment to farmers and rural communities in Minnesota. I believe also in your packet you'll find an executive summary of our program for federal fiscal year 2008 should be available to you. That year we opened 2,002 mediation cases. Almost 13% of those requested mediation, about 640 cases. 640 borrowers requested mediation, a 13% increase, in the rate from the previous year. Of those that didn't request mediation, some possible outcomes may have been they paid the debt current, they restructured the debt through their own discussions, filed bankruptcy, or maybe abandoned the collateral involved in the debt. Nearly 80% of mediated cases do reach a settlement, which means farms stayed in business, lenders and local businesses got paid, and people stayed in their communities. The total debt in 2008 that we mediated was $156 million. As I mentioned before, over $9.5 million of that was to locally owned businesses in rural communities throughout Minnesota. In addition, banks held about $126 million of that debt, and the FSA almost $7 million. The average farm debtor in mediation is a 53-year-old sole proprietor that's owned the land for 22 years. It's an average total agricultural debts of $273,000 and median family living expenses of $37,241. But we actually see all types, young farmers, older farmers, small farmers, big farmers, longtime farmers, and new farmers. So we have a full range in the program. The program operates very efficiently. We actually have two full-time staff, a program director and one administrative assistant that's full-time. All the other people involved in the program, mediators, financial analysts, administrative staff, are part-time and work as needed. As we look forward, the Center for Farm Financial Management at the University of Minnesota recently released a survey, and I believe this is also in your packet, of 2,300 ag professionals, including lenders, about their perceptions of the future outlook of financial outlook for their clients. 80% of lenders and 84% of ag professionals expect the probability that producers will experience financial stress in the next 3 years is high or very high. Based on these current economic conditions, we're seeing an increase in cases already. Over the past 3 months, the number of new cases we receive is up over the same period last year. Practically, we were working 100 more cases in February of 2009 than we were in February of 2008. Now, I've talked a little about the program and given you some numbers, and I'd like to have Jim, who's one of our staff members and is joining us today, to talk a little about how this works on the ground.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chairman Vickerman and Senators, I'm Jim Anderson. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I work with the Extension Service, and I work in the mediation program. I'm filling in today for Marinelle Preussler. She sends her greetings. She's on her journey through radiation and chemo, but she's doing well. I thought I'd give you an example of one of the mediations that took place probably 3 years ago that I was a part of. There was a middle-aged man that was taking care of his father and two sons. He had a 200-acre farm and 35 cows. He had an operating line that was secured by his dad's real estate, the family farm. He filed for mediation, and I met him at the first session. We put together a balance sheet and a cash flow. We had probably three or four meetings. Through that series of meetings, the participants joined in to find solutions. The solution to this happened to be 20 acres of wooded land that was purchased by someone in the metro area, and it paid off that operating loan and was able to also supply some more cows. He calls me every once in a while out of the blue, and he's still farming and doing well. If there's any questions, I'd be very happy to try and answer them.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd encourage the committee to consider extending the next sunset date on this out 4 years, where everyone knows the world and U.S. economies are free-falling right now, and there's never been a better time to have this kind of support system available for Minnesota farmers. And when we got a brief update, you remember, from Congressman Colin Peterson a couple weeks ago, and he reported to our group that nationally they're watching an uptick in dairy suicides. So, I mean, we want to make sure that as many supports are available for farmers as possible, and this is one of those strong, proven programs. And I would move the bill, sir.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, are there other testifiers?
Yep.
I'll wait until we're done with that.
Mr. Peterson. All these coming up members, I want you to realize that farmers are not immune from this shortfall that we're in, or this budget deficit. It's going to affect farmers, ag, just as much as anybody else. Mr. Peterson, welcome to committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Farmers Union. I'll be very brief. We would like to voice our organization's strong support for this bill authored by Senator Erickson Ropes. Farmers Union has been a long supporter of this program that started and has been running well, we believe, since 1986. That gives a chance to farmers to continue to farm by offering them a neutral party to mediate property debts. I've worked with many farmers on this program. There's other parts of this. The state has a good what's called a farm advocate program. I encourage you, as you hear farmers that have problems in getting into stress, we're talking to a lot of dairy farmers right now about this, and you can work with a farm advocate, and a lot of times that leads into the farmer lender mediation program. And so I remind the committee that very important program also. I think it's actually been 4 years since this was passed as a sunset 4 years ago. And I encourage the committee to think about what's changed in the last 4 years. I was in my local elevator this weekend, and corn was under $3 a bushel. We know we have catastrophically low dairy prices. We also know that we do have more growing organic niche type farmers who are entering these markets and are not quite getting it right sometimes, and they need to reorganize their business plans. And farmer lender mediation has offered a good opportunity for those farmers to continue. I've worked recently with somebody who started milking dairy goats and got into an old dairy barn and retrofitted the dairy barn. They were in the wrong type of program, and they had some issues, and they went into the program. I worked with a family who started growing has apples, and they did a value-added program with some ovens and things like that. So I encourage you to really think about this when we're talking about bumping that level up, that there's a lot of issues, and it's been working good for the last couple of years. And so I urge your consideration, and thank you for the time.
Ms. Kruger, do you want to add a little more to it? Or
I
No use. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think much of what I had intended to say has been covered. There was one point I wanted to make as an attorney that should the threshold amount be increased, those cases don't go away. They go somewhere. And where they're likely to go is Minnesota's overburdened court system. And I do think it's appropriate to think about the costs for the lenders in terms of sending out the mediation notices, but also part of the decision-making process must be the burden on the state. And I would submit that in many of these cases, the costs of going through a Chapter 12 bankruptcy for the creditors would be greater than the cost of going through mediation. So that was the main additional point that I don't think we've covered. And I think Tom alluded to the point that getting in early can be the most cost-effective way to address a problem. To address a problem after the dairy cows have been repossessed and then finally the land debt goes up for mediation, it's really hard to cash flow when the cows have already left and been repossessed.
Questions, members? Thank you both. Senator Erickson Ropes, we have a couple, three more testifiers. David Skilbred from the Independent Community Bankers, John Appitz, Farm Credit Services, and Mr. Johnson from the Minnesota Banking Association. Is there three chairs there? Mr. Skilbred, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is David Skilbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Erickson Ropes for the amendment that she offered today. We've met a few weeks with her, with all of the parties that were interested in that, and we had a very good discussion about all of the things that you've discussed so far today, and I want to thank her for the amendment that she offered. I do want to say for the record that we believe that this was a temporary program that was created during agricultural economic emergency and during the period of civil unrest. And while there's many challenges out there today, those two conditions that created the law in 1986 don't exist. And in 1986, it was created in for a two-year term. I talked to a author of the bill who participated in a very grueling conference committee back in 1986. And the comment that person made when I said, why did you choose it to be temporary, was we believe that there are some constitutional issues, which Mr. Appitz will discuss. And number two, in that one individual's opinion, it was created to respond to the civil unrest, not to create permanent banking policy. And I think that's what we've kind of backed ourselves into over the course of 22 years. And so what I would ask the committee to do is consider, and maybe not decide today, but to consider at least down the road, this issue of the trigger. And I'd like to just walk through this chart that you have in your packets a little bit more than we have done so far. As testimony indicated, that's right. In 2008, FY08, there were 2,002 cases opened because there was a $5,000 ag debt. Of those, 1,362 were waived. So the farmer had the option to go to mediation, and the farmer chose not to. And if you look down the column for the last five fiscal years, at a low, 61% waived mediation, and at a high, 70%. So around two-thirds of the time, regardless of the year, regardless of the number of cases opened, about two out of three times farmers say, no, I'm not going to go to mediation. The next column, column number five, shows the cases that were mediated. So in 2008, 640 of those 2,002 cases went to mediation, or about 32%. The next column shows those that reached settlement. So of those 640, 500 cases reached a settlement. Previous testimony indicated that 80% of the cases going to mediation were settled, and I'll assume that that math is correct. The other way to look at that, though, is 25% of the cases opened went to mediation and settled. Column number 8, as testimony showed, too, talked about the average ag debt per borrower, and average is kind of difficult to make, and I'll let the people who put the numbers together talk about that, which they did to some extent. But I want to just highlight, though, that in 08, the average ag debt was $273,521, which was a low for the last five fiscal years. In 2006, it was over $991,000. And when I look at that number, what strikes me is that number compared to the $5,000 trigger. 22 years ago, $5,000 was the trigger, and it seems that we have changed a lot in the last 22 years. We come with bills regularly that change COLAs and programs and all those other amounts. This committee, I believe, is going to consider a bill in the next couple of weeks which will increase the loan amounts for a number of programs that go through the Minnesota Ag Department. So, for example, the Shared Savings Loan Program that provides farmers to purchase new or used machinery will increase the loan amount. The new real estate loan program for beginning farmers, it'll go up from $200,000 to $300,000. A number of those, that's just an example. It seems to me that after 22 years, it would be reasonable to adjust this $5,000 amount in such a way that those farmers who are waiving mediation, and my gut tells me it's because the dollar threshold is too low, it'll recognize that fact and yet preserve the program for those who want to use it. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to thank you for your time and for the possibility to work on this bill with you.
Any questions, David? Mr. Kubik.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Skelbred. I guess, you know, do you happen to know what the average debt per borrower is that chose to go through mediation? I mean, it seems to me like that would be a better number for the committee than the average of every borrower.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, I can don't have the details of those loans. All I can say is what is ahead before you on this chart, and this is the information that's produced by the University of Minnesota Extension Service.
Follow.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, would the university know that information, or is this the number? I mean, you know, it's unclear whether.
Mr. Chair, Mrs. Denise may have that number.
Mr. Chair, the question. Members of the committee, the believe the number that we have on the executive summary in front of you is the amount of the debt, the average debt that was handled through mediation. So the 273,521 represents the debts that we did mediate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Now we have Mr. Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Abbott. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent Farm Credit Services here at the legislature. I do, first of all, want to thank Senator Erickson Ropes for the time she spent on this and the conversations we've had. Literally, she's got a lot of stuff on her plate. This is not a major sort of thing, but she's really dedicated a lot of time to it. So we very much appreciate her amendment and your consideration in addition to that amendment as well, because one of the things we said is let's extend the sunset and let's try to work on some of the other pieces. So thank you all for that, and particularly Senator Erickson Ropes. Couple caveats then to Senator Kubley's question, if I could start out that way. The average debt that is, What happens is the Extension Service has to report to the USDA, where part of the money comes from to support the program, certain statistics. And amongst those statistics are what's the average debt that had to be mediated. That's been one of the, and the number you've got, the 273,000 is the average farm debt that's mediated. Now, Senator Erickson Ropes will tell you that's an average, and an average isn't necessarily, I shouldn't speak for you, I'm sorry, but we've been through this conversation several times. An average is kind of in the middle. It's not the mean. It's not necessarily, you know, where the most of these lie. And the devil in these details has been that we can't get the figure to kind of figure out where to go with that $5,000 limit. I've visited with most of you, and I've made the argument that let's extend it for 4 years and let's raise the figure after 22 years, raise the threshold a little bit. The comment's been made, well, how many people fall below that threshold, fall below the number you're suggesting, Mr. Apitz, that $50,000 limit? And the answer is, I can't tell you. And we don't know. And I think there may be a little bit of a remedy to that that could resolve this problem and hopefully help us find a number. Before I tell you what that is, let me suggest the Extension Service is doing its job. It's reporting what it needs to report to the USDA. It reports all the figures that you see here and the figures on this chart, which are figures we drew from the executive summary that you have in front of you that's been published each of the last 5 years, five, 6 years, something like that. And I think that what's significant about that, if I could take you through this real quickly, is two things that David mentioned. Number one, about two-thirds of the mediations that are mediation notices that go out are waived. You send out two-thirds 2,000 mediation notices, and about 1,400 of those, they say, no, we don't need to go to mediation. I think the other thing that's of consequence is that third little column that says who's sending out these mediation notices. And the mediation notices are going out from banks and implement dealers. If you take a look at last year, the implement dealers who give credit to buy the combine, et cetera, also take a second in the property. They take a second in the agricultural land. So when you miss a payment, a good way to get your attention is to send out that foreclosure and mediation notice that says, by the way, missed the payment on the combine, I'll be taking your farm, thank you very much. That does get people's attention. The payment gets made, the mediation gets waived because you don't want to sit down with all the folks that you've got a debt to, and you simply waive that mediation. The serious ones, perhaps where there's a larger debt, and you're looking at the average per borrower ag debt of $270,000, those go into mediation. And what David and I and I think Steve will say is there's a number above 5,000 where we can save a lot of these mediation notices having to go out. I'm not quite sure what that number is, but the way you figure out what that number is you ask the Extension Service, of the 640 cases that were mediated, what was the triggering debt? What was the amount of debt that triggered that mediation notice? Shouldn't be too hard to figure out, shouldn't be too hard to go through it, and that's the number you need to get your hands on. I think that's the number we're all looking for. They don't do it now, and you'd have to kind of make a special request of some sort, but I don't know that sorting through that would be all that terribly difficult. And I'm kind of popping you on this, and I apologize at this point, but it kind of came to me the other day that that's the way to get to the number that we're all kind of looking for. If it's $5,000, then leave it where it is. If it's $25,000, that's kind of the where most of these happen, then move it to that. If it's, you know, if it's 50, so be it. I don't know if you want to go beyond that. I'm suggesting 50 because it seemed reasonable in light of this. But I think that's the way you get at the number that you're after. So, and one other last piece is we still have voluntary mediation. We still have voluntary mediation on the books. You still can go to the Extension Service and say, I'd like to mediate this debt. And let me tell you, there's not a lender out there who doesn't want to sit down and figure out a way to resolve this before they get into a foreclosure. You've all been through foreclosure discussions now with the mortgage situation, the home mortgage situation, and you all know that the lenders don't win out of that. Nobody wins out of that. We don't want to go there. There's still voluntary mediation if indeed a borrower wants to go in and have this conversation. So let me summarize. I wasn't brief, but let me summarize. Thank you very much for bringing this forward. Thank you very much for adopting the amendment. I'd suggest that we maybe just set this aside and get a little bit more information about what it is that's the triggering level, that causes people to go into mediation. You can look at 640 cases from last year, and you can kind of figure out what that number is. I'll kind of leave it at that and say there's also voluntary mediation out there. I know I've stymied your work a little bit here, but I think that's how we get to that number that everybody's asking about, instead of just kind of guessing.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Steve Johnson, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. The Minnesota Bankers Association represents about 95% of the banks operating in Minnesota. And I also would like to echo a thank you to Senator Erickson Ropes for sitting down with us and working with us on this issue and openness to discussing various issues. Thank the committee and Senator Erickson Ropes for the amendment today. We appreciate that. I think Senator Ropes said it right. We'd probably prefer the sunset, but I understand what's going on. So we want to work within the system we have to see if we can make it better. Mr. Appet said that foreclosures are not things lenders want, and that is correct. I mean, it's the last resort for lenders. So the members I work that are in my association work hard to avoid foreclosures at all costs. And I really appreciate the willingness of the author and all the stakeholders to work on some of the mechanics and the details of the farmer lender mediation. It has been in the books for a long time. So if we can get all folks together and review it, and that'd be, it's a good outcome. So with that, I'll just leave it at that. A lot of the other things I was going to say were already said. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
I want to ask all three of you bankers. 5,000, a good figure, too low, just for my own personal opinion. Five? You don't like five?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a basis for raising that, just looking at the numbers.
Okay, then if we don't raise in this committee, hopefully it'll get out of here and it'll go to judiciary. Senator Robes, maybe you can get a little more information when it goes to that committee, if you threshold.
Mr. Chair, my preference would be if the committee would pass this bill with just the date attached, and then if it's a pleasure of this committee, I think it would be a good thing to get together during the interim and get into the details of the program when we can get our minds wrapped around a little bit more information, because the program was started, 22 years ago for a particular purpose, but it's been working well, and there may be changing demographics in the ag community that we need to take into consideration, so just popping some numbers out there. So I just rather do it a little bit more carefully, and I do really believe in the stakeholder approach where everyone that's involved with this decision needs to be around the table coming to a decision that we can work with, build a consensus bill.
Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Erickson Rope. I have a couple of thoughts, and I don't know if anybody's talked to you about this or not, but since a large amount of the funding for this program is tied up in the federal farm bill, which is authorized every 6 years, why did you choose 4 years instead of 6 years?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Skoy, we're on the same page. That was exactly my initial thought, that we should sync it up with the federal farm bill, and I can't remember exactly why we decided not to do that. I think there might be some off years. It's not always 6 years, but to your point, exactly, I think we need to sync it up somehow with federal legislation.
Well, Mr. Chair, and if you have a reason for 4 years, I'm fine with that, but I just thought I'd ask the question. The other thing that I just have to say, is 1986, $5,000 is a lot different than $5,000 is in 2009. I mean, we're talking a load of fuel, more than that, or a couple of tires at the implement dealership, or, less than a tank of anhydrous, a couple 2.5-gallon jugs of pesticide, and a lot of times are more than $5,000. I can't believe that we want those sort of things triggering mediation. And, I mean, I don't know the mechanism for figuring out what the number should be, but I'm pretty sure that if you just look back at kind of what the value of money is, it has to have doubled in the last 23 years, probably more than that. But, you know, I heard a recommendation to ask Extension to get us some figures on what the numbers were. Is that something that you would consider, Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Yes, actually, and I think we need a discussion on those numbers exactly. We're talking about some median numbers instead of average numbers and, excuse me, trying to get to a point where we're looking at what would be an accurate trigger and then how many outliers fall below that trigger and how many are on the high end. So we have to understand a little bit more about the numbers. But I also want to make sure that we're keeping in mind that our agriculture community is really getting very diverse. We have very large producers and we have really small producers. And if we're embracing the local foods movement, and in my district I have like 300 small organics farms. We have a lot of people making ag livings off of serving the farmers market communities. You know, we want to make sure that we're capturing people who might benefit from this mediation process.
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Erickson-Ropes. Are you thinking that you would lay the bill over to find that data, or are you proposing that you'd like to move the bill out of committee today?
I prefer to move the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I would move to take the $5,000 to $10,000. I don't have any basis for it other than I'm pretty sure that the trigger mechanism that they had in 86 of 5,000, we've heard testimony that it's been working over the years, and you know, I'm supportive of this, but also I don't think we need to have this trigger mechanism being triggered for such a relatively small inputs on the farm level, and I just think that a larger number is better. So I would move changing 5,000 to 10,000.
I didn't quite hear that.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we increase the limit from 5,000 to 10,000.
To 10?
To 10.
Mr. Chair, I'm not, you know, terrifically opposed to that amendment, Senator Skoy, but to your point about there's no basis to attach the $10,000 number onto it, I'd really rather than just tossing a dart at the dartboard, I'd really rather understand the numbers before I go along with the change.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson-Ropes, I mean, there's kind of two ways to look at it. We know that there's been inflation occurring on fuel and stuff that farmers do. I'm pretty sure that it's doubled in the last 10 years, let alone the last 22. So I think that this is a pretty conservative movement. But, I'm not comfortable sending this out to say, well, some task force that's going to meet next summer is going to bring recommendations, because I know how things go around here. We very likely won't look at this again for four more years, and then it'll be reauthorized, and then it'll get looked at. So I'd like to make some small little movement in that area.
Senator Dale, on this amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, we oftentimes try to compromise around here, and the bankers have been talking about 50 grand or even 100 grand, and I know some of you are kind of fuzzy on exactly what you are recommending. But if we took the 50,000 and we're at 5,000 now and we compromised halfway in between, it would be substantially different than what Senator Scully is suggesting here. And so I think we should do at least what Senator Scully is suggesting, to just to make some movement toward where the bankers want us to be, because bankers are very important. We need you out there, and you come in here every two or four years, every 2 years I guess it is, and generally speaking, you come in here and want to get rid of this mediation program. That's what you generally want to do. But I think this time you said you want to keep it. At least the Farm Credit Bank, I think, said that. Did you say that? I think you did. So at least there's a recognition of value here. But I think we're in the business of lawmaking, and compromise is part of that. And I think we should accommodate some of their interests here. So I think we should do at least as much as Senator Scully is suggesting.
Ms. Kruger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to offer a some thoughts on the Skoy Amendment. And a couple of thoughts. I think I would support Senator Erickson Rope's caution in adjusting the amount without more information. And I think that it's easy to assume that we know why farmers waive mediation, but we don't necessarily know that they're saying, oh, it's too small a debt, let's waive mediation. There may be other concerns at play, and also farmers in the situation, if they're in default on a debt, they're in difficult situations. Maybe there's a health crisis. Maybe one member of the family has been laid off from an in-town job. Maybe there's been a natural disaster. There are a lot of things that may be going on in people's lives, and having to respond in 14 days to a mediation notice may not rise to the top of the list. Now, you can't say, okay, so it's not very important. But there are certainly farmers who don't return that mediation notice in a timely manner and then regret it. So I think keeping that opportunity open for farmers and making sure we're doing the outreach so farmers understand the importance and value of the program would be a good approach. And then specifically to the issue of increasing the amount, well, on the floor we have the amendment to double the amount. And I would suggest that we can't look at the farmer lender mediation program in isolation. There are other numbers that would put into state law in the 1980s during the farm credit crisis. For example, in Minnesota statutes 550.37, we've got the exemptions from creditor actions. And for farm machinery, that's specifically accepted, taken out from the automatic adjustment for inflation that some of the other items are subjected to. So if we've got a $13,000 exemption for farm machinery, should we also double that because it hasn't been adjusted in some 20 years or so? So then that would be up to $26,000. Elsewhere in Minnesota statutes, we've got income criteria for farmers to be eligible for legal services, low cost or free legal services. That's been fixed in place for 20 years as well at $15,000 adjusted gross income. You could make a very strong argument that that number should be adjusted upward for inflation as well. So I do think a cautious approach about studying these matters, not in isolation, but looking at if we're going to adjust one number for increases in cost of living, we should look at other numbers that may also be ripe for adjustment.
Mr. Schoenfeld, do you want to say something?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
This is the guy that did it. Could I just, while Mr. Schoenfeld's coming up, Mr. Chairman, again, John Appetz, say that we appreciate Senator Skoy, what you're attempting to do. If you can get her done around the committee, we'd appreciate some movement, and maybe we'll have some further conversation as this bill goes along, particularly with some other work that's going on in the other body.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and one of my clients is the Minnesota and South Dakota Farm Equipment Dealers Association. And I really just have a question, Mr. Chairman. I was sitting here, and I just a few minutes ago said to Mr. Appetz here that probably my people wouldn't care about this. But then it dawned upon me that I maybe should ask a question before I make that statement. And it is this. I think it is true that Senator Langseth and myself are probably the only two people in the room that were part of that whole discussion back then. We both served in the conference committee that wrote this. But I'm a little embarrassed to say that I haven't looked at the statute for a number of years and don't remember anything about it. So my question is this. The $5,000 limitation, I guess where I'm coming from is if a mediation were called, all parties are generally brought to the mediation table. If it were raised to $10,000 or $15,000 or $25,000 or $50,000, would that exclude, for instance, a farm equipment dealer that maybe was owed $9,500 as an example, and therefore he be excluded from coming to the table during a mediation that was called for farm credit services? Or I've kind of forgotten how the limitation, so I'm really sitting here a little embarrassed that I haven't looked at it recently enough to remember. So that's really my question, and I guess my question is really to counsel if he could verify or identify that for me. Because from our perspective, one of the things we wouldn't want is if there was a mediation that involved all the players as such that were involved, we would hate to be excluded because we were exempted under a dollar amount that was too small when the banks would get their money, but we wouldn't get ours. So that's my question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schoenfeld, the $5,000 is the trigger for the notice. It does state when the borrower sends in the mediation request, the mediation request form must include an instruction that the debtor must state all known creditors with debt secured by agricultural property and unsecured creditors that are necessary for the farm operation of the debtor. There's not a dollar limit on that. It's all, the dollar limit is on the notice itself. So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schoenfeld, if the person had debts that were less than that amount, they couldn't be brought into mediation. It just doesn't trigger the notice.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll look a little further into this matter. The one thing I wouldn't want to see happen is where the bank got its money, or its opportunity, but other people did not get their opportunity because they weren't notified or they didn't know about it. So. I know that the way you've just described it, that should not happen, but I'd like to look into it a little further as well, and I apologize for not being a little more informed.
Mr. Chairman, just a clarifying factor, though. However, if one of your group were to send out a notice to basically collect that was less than the threshold, you know, that would trigger mediation, and then you could depending on timelines and everything else, that could have an effect on whether your people are included or not.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for time to ask the question.
Any other discussion? One thing you want to remember, members, this is the Ag Committee. We got to look at what's the best for Ag. I don't serve on judiciary, and I'm not too sure anybody else I know here even serves on that. So whatever you think we ought to do, we ought to do it, and it goes to the next committee, and if you can change it to the next committee, fine. But I'd like to have it come out of this Ag Committee, what we feel is the right amount of money. Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion, but I would make sure that it included, there's evidently four sections that this number is related to with regard to farmer mediation. I would direct staff to make the appropriate changes in those sections.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to interrupt the
Senator Hahn, go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt the motion that Senator Scoy is making and to clarify that, but before we voted on it, I did have a question. I just wanted to pursue that. So maybe go ahead and get your motion in the form you want it here, and then we'll.
Mr. Chair, I would move the oral amendment to change $5,000 to $10,000 with the direction to staff to make the changes in the four sections that relate to farmer lender mediation.
Mr. Chairman, can I just I guess I'm looking for some clarification here, and I appreciate, Senator Scoy, you're raising the point. And Mr. Chairman, I think you're right that our obligation is to send this out in the way that we think is right, and we're reauthorizing a program that is sunsetting, and I think we ought to do that in good conscience that we have made the best decision we can. And I'm unclear, and maybe some of the bankers who are here can clarify this, that we've – I guess I've heard some mixed feeling about whether we should be doing this at all. And I think if the choice is to make the sunset go away completely or make it a permanent program or let it, you know, go away in 4 years, I understand that's one choice. But is there someone from the finance side that can answer the question of whether or not this program should be continued at all? We've heard a lot of testimony that suggests that this is a great thing, that everybody supports it, and if that's the case, I'd like to have the testimony reflect that. And maybe the people from the finance industry can explain if they do object to it and want it to go away, why, if this is a good program and everybody supports it and it's doing great things.
Mr. Chairman?
Abbott, maybe you could help us.
Sure. Farm Credit Services has a federal requirement. We have to try to restructure a loan before we go into a foreclosure. That's a federal requirement that's in place now. And
we will continue doing this. This is essentially mediation is what it is at a federal level, and we'll continue doing this going forward. So everybody's in. That makes it work that much better. And it does serve a lot of good purpose. I mean, what Jill is saying here is true. There is a lot of good in bringing people together. We think that raising that level where everybody has to come together would make a bit more sense, but bringing folks together is still a good idea.
Mr. Chair, David Skilbert again from the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. I guess the answer to the question from my mind goes back to the purpose and the creation of the program in 1986. And so what I would say is, number one, our lenders, you know, we've heard a lot about the mortgage crisis in the last couple of years. And one of the things that you always hear about with respect to the complications in that arena is that today mortgages are sold on Wall Street and mortgage-backed securities and carved up and all that sort of thing. So that complicates the conversation between those who hold the paper and those who live on the property. In this sort of situation, my banks make a huge portion of the ag loans out there. We still hold the paper. We are in those communities for those people to come and talk to should they have difficulties. We see them every day. We see them in the businesses, in the churches, et cetera. And likewise, if a payment is not made, we call up these folks. We talk to them. We ask them what's going on. We ask whether or not there's an illness or a job loss or other sorts of complications. So we're there to talk with them. The one thing that doesn't exist today that did exist in 1986 is this issue of civil unrest and agricultural economic emergency. Again, it seems to me as if the program was made for a point in time with the assumption that when the times change, the program would go away. Sometimes intention always doesn't happen. So we're here. Is the programming doing good work? Absolutely. Absolutely. What I'd like to contend, though, is that with respect to this modest and reasonable change that I think we're proposing, you could improve the program in order to update the monetary amounts, make them more realistic, and yet preserve it for those who wanted it.
Any other questions? Can you read the amendment so we know what we're doing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what it would be is, if you look on your A1 amendment, you'll see on line 1.5, you'll see a number of sections that are also being extended to 2013. In those sections is where the requirement for the notice is sent out, that it's sent out along with the collection notice. Depending on the type of event that's going on, that's the trigger for the mediation notice. So it happens in four places in 336.9-601, in those two subsections, and also in 553.65, 559, and then 582. So what Senator Scoy's amendment is to increase that $5,000 trigger in each of those sections. So there's four sections of statute where the $5,000 would be change to $10,000, and we can get that ready later.
You understand that amendment, Senator?
I do, and I'm voting against it.
Can you live with that, or can't you?
I'll live with the committee's decision, Mr. Chair.
Well, as I said before, if this is an ag committee, if we feel that's where it should be, I can't tell you what's going to happen when it goes to judiciary. Mm-hmm. But I was going to send it out of here with something that we thought was reasonable and fair. So is there any further discussion? Senator Scoy's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No, adopted. Well, Senator, your bill is the way I think you wanted it. Or not? Maybe not the way you wanted it. It's the way to get it out of here.
It's the way it is, Mr. Chair. And I would move that Senate File 289 is amended. We recommend it pass.
Senator Rose moves that Senate File 289 be recommended and passed, and it be referred to as amended, and be recommended, and it will be referred to Judiciary. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So adopted. Another bill, time to run the short. We'll keep going. Next bill up is Clean Water Report. Is that gentleman here?
The last time he was on a farm was back in 1986.
Well, wait a minute, he passed by one the other day.
John Jasky, are you here? Welcome to committee. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm here to give a short presentation. I'll try to make it even shorter than I had planned, given your schedule. I know the senator wants to get her bill up if she can today. So what I was going to do is give you an overview of some clean water policy things that are moving forward in other committees. Certainly members of this committee that are part of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee have heard some of this before, and we can certainly come back and give you more detail. But the reason we were going to do this, and we'll do a very brief version of it, is that the bill that you're going to be considering has connections to conservation and clean water as in an agricultural setting. These farm conservation plans that the bill refers to, the purpose of those would be to achieve conservation benefits on a farm-level scale. We certainly have plans at the statewide level, national level, and local level, but in order to really achieve those clean water and conservation benefits, they have to happen on land, and that land is the majority of the state that has those issues is privately owned, and some of which is on agricultural settings. So just as in a way of introduction to the bill, I'll have you turn to this presentation in your packet if you have it with you. It looks like this with a couple of pictures on. I'll have you jump all the way over to page 5 just to get right to the heart of this. Certainly the information part of that talks about some of these larger level planning efforts, but the diagram on the bottom of page 5 is a very simplistic diagram which kind of indicates what we might expect to see. Very simplified version, mind you. We have a little diagram here that shows a portion of a farm that has some diagrams on it showing some conservation practices that could be considered by that particular landowner. Now, the conservation plan could go into much more detail and often do, getting into nutrient management, productivity, and some of the technology that we know is out there today and is used for farming purposes. If you turn to page 6, I'll just briefly show you some examples of some of those kinds of practices that we have programs in the state that our agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, administers. We also work very closely with the Department of Agriculture on a number of these initiatives. And you can see some of those practices there in the bottom of the page that would result from a plan that would be prepared on behalf of that landowner. And these projects are funded in part with public dollars, and there's also a cost-sharing component the landowner is expected to provide. There's more information in here about some of our drainage management efforts, our Reinvest in Minnesota wetland restoration projects, and so on and so forth. But I think in the interest of getting to Senator Erickson Ropes' bill, I will pause, and we'll take questions maybe as part of her bill discussion, and I can go into more details at some point in the future. So with that, I will take a break, Mr. Chairman, and answer any questions you members may have.
Senator Dale.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jasky, this bill that Senator Erickson Ropes has, is this one that was about or endorsed by your department, or is this something you helped put together, or where did this come from?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill, it's not an agency bill. I'll let Senator Erickson Ropes talk about the genesis of the bill. We had a conversation with her last week, Friday, I think it was, and talked about some of the things that we felt might need a little more work, but the idea in there has some merit.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your report. Mm-hmm. Senator Ropes, you have the last bill. Senate File 771.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm putting this bill before the committee today. It just as a starting point. I'm not going to ask for a vote on this bill, but I want to bring this bill to the committee so we can get some input from you on suggestions on or reaction to this bill. I got this bill from Representative Junkie, who's introduced the concept, I think, a number of years, and he's interested in moving this forward and having a conversation on conservation plans for farms in Minnesota. And it's my understanding that Mr. Jasky is going to be working really closely on trying to pull all this together. I have met with the stakeholders who would be involved with this sort of thing, Farm Bureau, farm agencies, the reps for the commodity groups, the water folks, and trying to get a sense of what people think about the idea. And there's a lot of recommendations for change in this bill. So I wanted to bring the bill to the committee, kind of talk about it a little bit, and see what your recommendations are as we continue to work outside a committee on this bill. So Mr. Jasky maybe could walk us through the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, I'll do my best to describe what's in the bill. The first part on page 1.11 there, the definition of this conservation plan, talks about what this plan is, you know, describes it as a set of documents. We might choose to think of it as a set of analysis and recommendations that may be documents, it may be electronic, but it's information that is provided by experts to the landowner to help them understand the opportunities to do conservation and maybe some productivity increases on their in their operation, but focused on conservation principally. One of the things that you see then looking down below, it defines farm unit, which is basically on line 2.3, the you know, the definition of what is a farm, and you had a lot of conversations about that earlier today, but or at least things related to it. Certainly, it's the land that is in productivity purposes for agricultural uses, and this would apply to those landscapes. And so that's, I think, the way we would view that. I think one of the other things that people have asked about, and we have as well, is you get on to page 2.28, okay, that talks about this date and then something happens. The way this is written is that unless you have one of these plans in place, you would not be eligible for cost-sharing funds for some of those projects that I was describing in that very brief presentation. So in some ways it makes it mandatory that you have one of these plans in place before you're eligible to get cost-share funding from whatever sources. One of the things that we've communicated to Senator Eggs and Ropes is that we think there's an approach that would be better to build this in as a eligible practice or maybe as part of the first project that a landowner would do on their property rather than saying you have to have it all in place before you do anything on your land, because certainly there's going to be, she used the analogy when we discussed it, of sort of a hospital setting, you know, where sometimes you just got to fix the problem before you come up with a plan for the whole patient's health. You know, you have to be able to target certain things and just take care of it. But while you're talking to them about their health concerns, you might be able to work on other issues that they may also be interested in taking care of. And that was her analogy, not mine. I'm trying to repeat it, but probably not so well. So our suggestion was to not make it a mandatory thing that'd be in place beforehand, but build it into the work that that landowner, that farmer, would be interested in undertaking now and then into the future. The rest of it, getting on to page 2.33, the definitions there, saying that really, you know, those that have gone into the effort of developing these plans ought to be given some priority, you know, in terms of the funding that's available for clean water and conservation purposes. It talks about the role of a district board. The Soil and Water Conservation District is the local government that works with landowners to implement these projects, often using both state and federal money in partnership through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then the last piece of this bill is this conservation task force that really requests the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Agriculture to pull together this task force, to put together, you know, kind of a set of findings and recommendations in a broad way for what landowners, farmers can use to achieve conservation benefits. And I haven't looked at that piece of it real carefully about the expectations there, but I think they're actually, you know, there's quite a bit of language there that you can look at for your own purposes. And then they're asking for a report to back to the legislature saying what the recommendations are from this task force. So that's the way I would view the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I'll stand for any questions and let Senator Erickson Ropes offer anything that she wants to in addition.
Senator Ropes, I have two witnesses that wanted to speak. to your bill, Judy Erickson and Tim Kiske. They'd come up. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And I'm really just pinch hitting tonight for Leanne Bach, our executive director. Our leadership team is in Washington, D.C. I just have a couple of comments that we have initially on this legislation. Thank you very much for putting this forward. It's a great idea, something that used to be done on a regular basis, but has kind of fallen by the wayside. I think we are very interested in working on this legislation. We have a number of questions relating. Our folks are the ones who are going to put this in place. The Soil and Water Districts are going to be charged with putting the conservation plans and working with the farmers. So, of course, we would have a number of questions that we would want to see addressed relating to workload, costs, standards for planning, making sure that our membership and our staff are adequately trained and prepared to do this work. And then also in looking at the task force that is being created to kind of outline and move forward with this program, we would like representation on that task force as they work to put this into place. Those are our initial comments, and we appreciate the opportunity to work with you on this. Thank you.
Tim Kiske.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tim Giesecke. I'm here representing the Minnesota Project, a non-policy policy organization. I work on federal farm policy and state issues. I also manage a farm in Nicollet County and have a business that deals with environmental quality assurances for cattle and dairy operations. I do believe that a conservation plan, like any plan regardless of a business or not, is required for success. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So I think at a 40,000 foot level, it's necessary to have a plan to reach your goals. With that said, in 2005, I recognized the need for a conservation plan and have worked with agriculture professionals and farmers in bringing that into a practical manner. And so the document I work off today is called Modernizing the Conservation Plan. It began in the 30s. It basically went away in the 80s. And it went away for many reasons. But what we have done is rebuilt it using USDA newer tools and using some of the 800 crop advisors in Minnesota and some of the 13,000 crop advisors in the United States, people that are on the ground in conjunction with the soil and water staff, and integrating the conservation plan with the production plan. And that provides ownership at the farm level. And it really provides an assurance, or it could provide an assurance to, like, Bowser, that their cost share dollars are used in a manner that addresses the whole farm and hopefully can provide value to some of the regulatory issues as we do with TMDL. The one component I would say that needs to be added onto a conservation plan is an assurance piece. We implement practices. We don't necessarily have the tools to measure the results. And the technologies are there today to add that, and that would be one of the pieces of modernizing the conservation plan. So I appreciate this direction. I think the task force is an excellent idea. I think the agriculture workforce out there is willing to participate. I think we make it practical and add value to it, and I think we can achieve the clean water legacy goals that our state intends to do. So,
thank you. Mr. Schoenfeld, do you want to come up in? Mr. Bond?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and the hat I'm wearing at this point in time is with the Minnesota Soybean Growers. And I wanted to first thank the senator for contacting us last week to talk about this. And the only position here, I'm not here to speak against the bill exactly. It's just that we have had a conference amongst a number of soybean growers to discuss this, and they have raised a number of concerns. And since this is a hearing basically to kind of air these concerns, I've discussed some of these concerns with Senator Erickson Ropes and would just like to share a few with you. As was indicated by the previous speaker, these conservation plans have been around for a long time, going back to the 30s after the Dust Bowl. And there is one thing that soybean growers that I've talked to are concerned about, however, in terms of the change, kind of the nuance of what a conservation plan is all about. If you go back in time and you look at the programs that the federal government brought forth, including the conservation plans, there was a time, as an example, in which the federal government actually paid for tiling of your farm. There were times when they paid for terraces and waterways and a lot of other things that were conservation practices. But the primary purpose throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s primarily was a move towards increasing the productivity of the land. It was not necessarily looking at such things as wildlife habitat or carbon sequestration, those kinds of issues that have come up since. And so there is, I think there is a concern by a number of people as to what direction this is going to take us. So it is really about the unknown, probably, that people are concerned, are a little bit hesitant to be supportive of such a plan. First of all, within the legislation, at least that I could determine, I'm not certain that there's a clearly stated goal as to what these conservation plans are attempting to bring about. Are those goals, in fact, about wildlife habitat? Are they about conservation for conservation's sake, erodible lands, those kinds of things, or are they about productivity for the farmer? When you look through the statute that this is being put into, you will find one phrase that specifically declares that if it is for productivity only, that funds from this cannot be used. State funds cannot be used for the productivity section. So that's a bit of a statement as to how this all fits together. Other questions that came up were about, for instance, with the task force. How much farmer input is involved here? A lot of the task force that's declared in this bill involves state bureaucracy. And there's a concern by a lot of farmers that it not be from a top-down kind of a situation, but more from a bottom-up kind of a situation. And they have concerns about what the task force takes a look at, and again, from what is the stated goal and purpose. Question has come up. Mr. Jaski indicated whether it was voluntary or whether it was mandatory. Well, it's been portrayed primarily in discussions that I've, not with Senator Hanson Robes, but with others, as a quote, voluntary program. But when money is used as a club, it becomes less voluntary and more mandatory. Then when you take a look at that, there's a question about that. For instance, if we're going to involve state monies or ultimately maybe as you join this with federal programs, federal monies as well, if we have a conservation program or plan, for instance, that would require 10 different things on a farm. In other words, maybe it needs a waterway, maybe it needs no-till operations in particular areas, maybe it needs a woodlot in another area. Then the question becomes, is the direction then that in order to get funds from the state or ultimately maybe the federal government if it's tied into it, would those funds then only apply if we met all 10 of those things that were in the conservation plan, or would it apply for if we just simply wanted to put in a waterway as an example, that we could get assistance there? So these kinds of questions are there. And there are a number of others. One of the big ones that also came up is that there's a provision in the bill that speaks specifically to the idea that these funds would be used in a higher priority to producing a conservation plan for any farm located wholly or partly within a watershed that's listed as an impaired water under PCA. And the way it's written, it basically says that as long as it's an agricultural problem, that would be the highest priority. There is the question raised, does this then give an incentive to a local soil water conservation district, as an example, to actually include more things in an impaired water situation because more funds then would be available because it would have a higher priority. And farmers are a little concerned about that as well. So there are a number of questions. I've got others that could be raised, but the purpose I just wanted to simply make you aware of was that at least from the organization I work with, there are a number of questions. They do think this needs time to be sorted out and taken a look at a lot of different issues. And so we just ask that, I don't believe the bill is moving forward today, but I would ask to be participants in it as this whole idea progresses.
Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Bond, representing the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers and the Minnesota Certified Crop Advisors. And to, first of all, compliment the Senator for, I think, a forward-looking approach to conservation. And I think the challenge for crop production is to get on the green side of a lot of the efforts that are also being recognized. And this, I think, is a very interesting bridge between the two approaches, both production and conservation. And while neither the retailers, the dealers, if you will, or the certified crop advisors have specifically endorsed this, the point of my remarks would be to say that as you move forward, I think you would want to include a representative from the Certified Crop Advisors Board of Directors. They have one here in Minnesota, and also the crop production retailers who tend to hire those 750 crop advisors that are in the state, and most of them underused in some of these areas. So I'd offer that as something to work with and suggest if and when this moves forward. Thank you.
Members, it's 5:30. We've got a little work to do on this bill, so Senator Oaks, quickly.
Mr. Chair, I just would be anxious to hear any feedback from members. They can either do that today or maybe if they want to talk to me individually as we move forward on this plan. As you know, I'm a big stakeholder fan, so I do like to get everybody that's going to be involved with a bill around the table, try to do as much consensus building as possible. So I think it's a really good point that we don't always want to do top-down approaches, you know, where the state is directing what must happen on a local farm unit, that we need farmer participation from the bottom up as well. But if you have a chance to read through, if you're hearing from constituents or other groups, please send your suggestions or concerns along to me as we continue to build this bill. But I'm real interested in hearing feedback from you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I think we should get a fiscal note on it, and we need to know what the cost is to get a conservation plan out to every farm in the state.
Senator Dale, we'll figure that out because the tax force costs money. This is a piece of work in progress, put it that way. And there are other questions, members. We are adjourned.